increasing our passion for God in the new year. That is going to be the theme of the 5 Sunday morning sermons in the month of January. Let me begin this morning by asking you to consider 5 questions for yourself. Question number 1. Ask yourself, what is the greatest passion in my life? Many people are passionate about insignificant things. Many people are passionate about sinful things. What is the greatest passion in my life? Question number 2. What would those who are closest to you say is the greatest passion of your life? And would their answer be the same as your answer to question 1? What would your family, what would your co-workers say is the greatest passion of your life? Question number 3. Ask yourself, am I satisfied with my passion for God where it stands right now? That's just a yes or no. Yes or no. Question number 4. What would I have to change in my life in order for God to be its greatest passion? What would I have to start doing or stop doing for God to be my greatest passion? Question number 5. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being cold, 5 being lukewarm, and 10 being hot, how would I rate my relationship to God on this New Year's Day? 5 questions. We are going to look at those same five questions every Sunday morning in January about increasing our passion for God. And as the month goes on, we will see how the answer to some of those questions in your life will change. Now, let me share with you one verse that deals with passion. In Romans the 12th chapter, and in verse 11, Paul says to us that we are to be fervent in spirit. Fervent in spirit. The word fervent there means to be hot. It actually means to boil. What Paul is saying in its context of Romans 12 is that there is to be a deep eagerness on the behalf of every Christian toward their responsibilities to God. And brethren, that verse is all about passion. Now let me give you one quotation about passion. It was a French military strategist who said this: "The most powerful weapon on earth is the human soul set on fire." The most powerful weapon on this planet is not a nuclear warhead. It is a human soul that has been set on fire. That's all about passion for something in life. Brethren, do we understand this morning that it is passion that is often the difference between success and failure? And if there is one thing in the Christian life that is absolutely vital, what is vital in the Christian life is that we have to be a people who have a passion and an ever-increasing passion for God. So the question we raise this morning and all month is this: how do we increase our passion for God? Now, follow and listen to me carefully. How do we increase our passion for God? This month, we are going to be looking at several things. Now follow. And each one of these things is going to involve us looking in a different direction. This morning, the direction we are going to look, and there's just one thought this morning, but the one direction we are going to look is that this morning, I want us to go back. I want us to go back and to stand underneath the cross. Here's what I'm asking. Stay with me. Here's what I'm asking. I'm asking you this morning to step out of yourself. And I'm asking you to go back in your mind's eye and to stand underneath the cross of Jesus Christ. Now follow me very carefully.
Crucifixion. Crucifixion was the most vile death ever devised in the wicked imagination of man. Crucifixion was developed by the ancient Persians. We know from secular history that crucifixion was used by the Greeks under Alexander the Great. But though it was the Persians that developed crucifixion, and though it was the Greeks that used it, it was the Romans who perfected it. Now, a crucifixion victim, as a rule, was first subject to what was called a flogging, or your translation may say a scourging. We know in the case of Jesus, according to John chapter 19 and in verse number 1, that the very first thing that Pilate did is that Pilate handed Jesus over to be flogged or to be scourged. I'm going to use the expression flogged. Let me say to you this morning that any attempt to describe this is going to turn your stomach. There were two forms of flogging. First, there was the Jewish form of this torture. But the Jewish form of flogging had limits that were set to it. According to Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 1, 2, and 3, the flogging could not consist of more than 40 lashes. There were limits to it. But the second form of flogging was the Roman form of flogging. And the difference between the two is that the Romans had no limit on the number of lashes. The victim being flogged was at the mercy of the one that was doing the flogging. The Romans referred to flogging as, quote, the little death. The instrument of torture was called a flagellum. It was a stick that was between 14 and 18 inches long. And it had leather straps that came out from it. And on the end of those leather straps, there were tied pieces of bone and pieces of metal and pieces of rock and pieces of shred pottery. The administrator of this flogging was a Roman soldier who was called a lictor. It's L-I-C-T-O-R. The lictor was the man who administered the torture. The lictor was a Roman soldier who possessed two qualities. Number one, he was heartless, and number two, he was cruel. The victim of the flogging. The victim of the flogging, in this case Jesus, was an individual who was stripped naked. They were bent over a stump and then they were secured to that stump. The beatings would begin at the upper part of the back, And the lictor would work his way down to the lower part of the legs. And every time the lictor would draw back the flagellum and bring it down, flesh would rip off. And as he continued with stripe after stripe after stripe, after stripe, after stripe, after stripe, after stripe, after stripe, what finally would begin to happen is that the muscles underneath the flesh would literally shear themselves from the bone. The victim of the flogging always passed out. And when the victim passed out, they took buckets of salt water and poured on them, which of course shocked the system and brought them back to consciousness. They were brought back to consciousness so that the flogging could continue. Many a man, history records in detail, died on that stump. Many of a man went insane on that stump, who completely lost his mind in the pain and the torture. When the flogging was over, Jesus was then led away to the place where he would be executed. When Jesus was led away from the flogging, he would have been accompanied by four Roman soldiers who would have formed a box around him, and Jesus would have been in the middle of them. The cross, actually, the cross beam from the cross was then laid upon his lacerated back, and the victim was then made to carry the cross beam of that cross to the place of execution. And in the case of Jesus, which was so often the case, the victim would succumb and collapse under the weight of the cross. And in the case of Jesus, they got a man by the name of Simon, and they made Simon carry the Lord's cross the rest of the way toward Calvary. As Jesus would have been led out of the city of Jerusalem, and these four soldiers having formed that box around him, with him in the middle, there would have been a great crowd. And in fact, we are told there was a great crowd that followed this. And as a part of this crucifixion procession with the victim and the soldiers and the great crowd, this great crowd of procession would also have been accompanied by a group of women who would have sung along the way a funeral dirge, a funeral song. And this is what happened in the case of Jesus, according to Luke chapter 23 and verse 27. Having arrived outside the city to the place of Calvary, Jesus would have then been laid down on the ground on top of the cross. The cross would have been under him. And spikes would have been taken and driven into his hands. The word hands is literally his arm, probably his wrist area, and into his feet. For the very, very first time in 1968, first time ever, archaeologists excavated a young man who had been crucified in the Roman time period. and wedged into one of this young man's heels was a 7-inch spike. So they drove these spikes into his arm and into his feet, and he was lifted up on that cross.
A crucifixion victim, a victim of crucifixion, their cause of death was actually twofold. Number one, they died from a loss of blood. From all of the lacerations of the flogging, to the spikes that were driven into the arms and into the feet, we are told that at the foot of those crosses, there would be puddled a literal river of blood at the foot of these crosses. They died of a lack of blood, a loss of blood. But the second cause of death in the victim of a crucifixion is that they died from the inability of being able to breathe. Imagine in this position trying to inhale and exhale. Your chest cavity from the hanging on the cross, your chest cavity was slumped. So in order to raise it up and in order to draw or inhale a breath, you would have to raise yourself up. But to raise yourself up, you are putting pressure on the spikes that are driven in your feet. You are putting pressure on the spikes that are driven in your arms. But you can't breathe. You raise up, you draw breath, or you die. And he raises himself up. The victim would then inhale and then slump himself down. And when he could hold that breath no more, he would go through this process over and over and over again. And each time he raised himself up, and each time he forced pressure to his arms and his feet, the blood was just squirt from the body as he struggled to live. And we know from Mark's account that for 6 godless hours, Jesus struggled over and over and over to draw breath. I want you to consider all this for a moment. I want you to consider all this for a moment. I want you to consider the physical torture in this. The lacerations from the flogging. Bones and nerves now exposed from the upper back to his lower limb. The physical torture of the spikes being driven in. The physical torture of the weight of the cross trying to bear it to the place where you would be executed. Just consider for a moment the physical torture involved in this. And then, for a moment, consider the mental torture of this. The mental torture of this. The crowd screaming, "Crucify him! Kill him! Away with him!" the mental torture of the Roman soldiers who mocked him, who made fun of him. Imagine the mental torture of peering down from that cross, and your mother is at the foot of the cross screaming, "Somebody stop this!" But this wasn't going to be stopped. Consider for a moment the physical torture. Consider for a moment the mental torture. And then consider for a moment the social torture, the embarrassment of this. You are stripped naked. You are being spit on repeatedly. They have taken you and paraded you around, and basically you have become a sideshow for everybody's sickness. Please do not turn me off right now. Please do not shut me down right now. Please, please, don't phase out here. I want you now to go back. I want you to go back. And in your mind, you can do this. And as humans, we are the only ones who have the ability to do this. I want you to go back in your mind and imagine what it was like for you to walk outside that city, to go up on that little hill of Calvary. Imagine what it would be like to have stood there underneath that cross. You're standing there underneath that cross. Now, I want you to look up. And as you look up at that cross, I want you to look and tell me, look in his face, tell me, what do you see? You say, well, I see pain. Yes, yes, but look in his face. Look. What else do you see? You say, I see blood and it's everywhere. Yes, but look in his face. What else do you see? You see, well, I see agony. Yes, there's agony. But look in his face. What else is there? You say he's quivering and his body is in convulsions. And yes, but look beyond the pain. Look beyond the blood. Look beyond the agony. Look into his face and look in his eyes. Do you see it? It's there. Look, it's there. You can see it. It isn't pain. It isn't hate. It's love. It's love. Now look at him. Look at him. Stand at the foot of the cross. Look at him. And now tell me you don't care. Look at him. And now tell me your heart is cold to what you see. Look at him. Look into the face
of the one who died for you and then tell me you don't have passion about this. C.S. Lewis said, the one thing that Christianity can never be is moderately important. How do I increase my passion for God? Then Pilate released Barabbas, and Pilate handed Jesus over to be flogged. And they led him away to be crucified. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the headquarters. And they gathered the whole battalion of soldiers. And they stripped Jesus of his clothes and put a scarlet robe on him. They twisted together a crown of thorns and they put it on his head. And they put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, the soldiers mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spit on him. And they took the reed and struck him on the head with it. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of his robe. And they led him away to be crucified. And when they came to the place called Golgotha, there they crucified him. How do I increase my passion for God? I go back. And I stand underneath that cross and contemplate that all of this was done for me. How do you understand that and then the church not be important to you? How do you understand that and not have a passion for what God has done? How do I increase my passion for God? I go back and I stand under that cross. And I see this river of blood. And I look up. And I see the body of deity quivering, soaked in blood, being unable to imagine what he's going through, and then understanding that he's done this for me. When that registers in my mind and in my heart, I'll be fervent in spirit.
and I'll understand the most powerful weapon on earth is the human soul that's been set on fire. A fire that is a passion for God. This morning, increase your passion for God. Come right now as together we stand and as we sing.